Welcome to today's SNEB webinar on Federal Policy 101. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB and glad you're joining us for the presentation today. A little housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, there is a handout, which are the slides for today's presentation. You may want to download those and follow along. I did notice a couple slides that have quite a bit of detail on them, so they might be helpful to have in front of you as we go through the presentation. We will take questions, and actually our presenters have said if there's a question pertinent to a specific section that they're discussing, that they're happy to stop and answer that question. So as we're going through the presentation, go ahead and type your questions in the question block. We can take care of those as we're going through the presentation, but then also we'll have time at the end to do that as well. And then when I close out the webinar, there is a short survey. I appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as ideas for future policy sessions. We'd really love to have that input. And then watch for an email later this week with the link to the recording, the slides that you're making that we have today, and then the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance. So I will go ahead and introduce our presenters. We have Joe Cron, who's president of Paragon Government Relations. He's the president and managing partner of Paragon Government Relations. He directs the firm's day-to-day operations and provides hands-on lobbying services to the firm's clients. A 25-year veteran of Paragon, Joe has dedicated his entire career to promoting the interests of public sector clients before Congress and executive branch departments and agencies. And then Tom Joseph is Vice President of Paragon Government Relations. Tom heads up the firm's health, human services, and housing practice. He has actually worked with SNEB, I think, for over 20 years. Tom is the face behind the policy update that you have seen. If you might have noticed, the policy update has gone from every week to every other week. And one of the reasons for that was the ability to do use Tom's expertise for other things, such as a training like we're doing today. So with that, I will go ahead and let them take it over.
Thank you, Rachel. Why don't we go to the next screen, please? And I think with that next screen, you've done a great job of introducing us. Those are our emails. And yes, I've had the pleasure of working with SNEB for about 15 years worked very closely with the ACCP. And as Rachel noted, do the now biweekly SNEB updates. I do the lion's share of that work. And now, over this next year, I'm going to be participating in sort of policy 101 types of webinars. And my colleague Joe Cron, as you heard, does a lot of the sort of the bricks and mortar work, but strategizes with me on lobbying, reviews materials that I put out. It's a really good partnership that I have with Joe and the firm. Anything to add, Joe, before we move to the next slide?
Yeah, let me just take this chance to say thank you, Rachel, for the introduction. And folks are still rolling in here. But yeah, just appreciate the opportunity to be with you and to provide this update. So thanks. And with that, Tom, I think we can roll into the slides.
Okay. Next slide, Rachel. Thank you. So today's objectives are pretty straightforward. Joe and I are going to walk through with you the fundamentals of the federal legislative budget and regulatory processes, really get down to sort of some of the key timelines and concepts. We're not going to go into any great detail on anything, but we will give you those highlights. And after we do that, we're going to talk about how you can help shape nutrition policy with your federal legislators. And throughout, as Rachel noted, we would be happy to entertain questions. In fact, we decided to offer a special today of unlimited participant questions. Next slide, Rachel. These are the nutrition educator competencies that are the best fit for this conversation, this webinar today. You'll see that we will talk a little bit about how you may be able to describe the role of government agencies in regulating food systems and nutrition. We hope you'll learn from this webinar to be able to describe the purpose and process of nutrition legislation to address food security. And then finally, sort of to describe the role of organizations with a focus on the congressional committees in shaping and implementing nutrition policy. Next slide, Rachel. So the source document, the first sentence of the Constitution addresses the legislative body. So you can see that. I don't need to read it through with you, but the first article of the Constitution addresses all of the powers of the legislature, not only the House but the Senate. So it clearly was top of mind when our founders wrote the Constitution. Let's move to the next slide and begin to talk about the legislative process. So 10 bonus points for anybody that can read everything on this slide. This slide is really more to just give you a sense of how legislation flows, how there are multiple paths for legislation. It can become convoluted, it can become complex, it can become a year-in, year-out process. So what we're going to do today, I mean, this is it's a good slide, but what we really want to do today is provide you with some of the basic steps that you may have learned at some point in civics class. So this will be a refresher for some of you, or hopefully, in addition to a refresher, you'll be able to add on to your knowledge of the legislative process. Next slide, Rachel. So here is a much more simplified overview of the legislative process on just on one frame. As you can see, those first four steps, and we'll get into more detail in a second, but those first four steps address the processes that both the House and Senate will go through. First of all, of course, is bill introduction. In both the House and or Senate. Those bills, when they're introduced, they're given a bill number, HR for House of Representatives, and S for the Senate. When the bill is introduced, it is referred to committees, either one or multiple committees in either the House and the Senate. At some point, the committee may consider the bills. And then further along the process, it will be floor consideration. So those first four steps, which Joe will get into a little bit in more detail, are steps that both the House and Senate will undertake when they're considering legislation. And then the final three steps are more of the cooperative process between the two bodies. Next slide, and I'll turn it over to Joe.
Thank you, Tom. So, yeah, and as you saw, we saw sort of the flow and how that goes. And again, I think probably most folks are sort of familiar with the basics of that process. But we'll get into it in a little bit more detail here. So, bill introduction. I'll say this: you know, any member of Congress, from backbencher, brand new member, to the most senior members of Congress, can introduce a bill or a resolution. There are several types of resolutions, concurrent resolutions, and different things, which we won't get into all the nuances there. But really what we're talking about today is just the straightforward pieces of legislation, bills. So as Tom said, an HR, House of Representatives number, House bill, or S, Senate bill number is really what we're focusing on for purposes of this discussion. Again, any member can introduce a bill. You have all different types of legislation, if you will. You've got big, huge you know, sweeping bills like you're seeing actually right now in the current Congress and what you saw last year, you know, the bills dealing with obviously the coronavirus pandemic. These are massive pieces of legislation, catch-all, that were introduced generally by, you know, key committee chairs. And you saw a lot of other members trying to, you know, get their own sort of, you know, pet pieces of legislation attached to the broader bill. But then you have everything right down to, you know, a private piece of legislation, let's say trying to, you know, provide, you know, immigration relief, let's say to individual citizen or something that's going to help out an individual corporation. Some of the bills are simply, quite frankly, messaging bills or done for political purposes. They're introduced, you know, in this case, it might be a minority member who introduces a bill, says, I know the majority will never take this up, but this is a messaging bill. You know, they do a press release on it. It sits there. It's used as a bargaining chip or to try to, again, sort of paint a certain political picture. But in other words, there's different reasons and why bills are introduced and different types of legislation. We'll talk a little bit later about like the budget appropriations process and how that differs from, let's say, a bill that's authorizing a new program or modifying an existing program. But number two on here, committee, that's key.
I'll just jump right in here. So also on introduction, as Joe would tell you, is in the House over the 2 years, we may see 6,000 to 7,000 bills introduced. And same on the Senate side. All of those bills at the end of a 2 year session die, no matter where they are in the process. So very few make it all the way through the process. The other item to note is when a bill is introduced, it's really important to take a look at, as Joe noted in terms of the messaging bill, if a member is from the minority party, that bill probably has very little chance of even being considered by the committee. And or if that member serves on the committee of jurisdiction, which Joe's going to talk about in a second, if that bill is referred to a committee where that member serves, there is a slightly better chance that measure will be considered, especially if the member is from the majority party. And more importantly, perhaps, if that member is higher up in the rank and file of that committee.
Thanks for that, Tom. Yeah, I think that's a key point. You know, the idea that everything Congress really is very much a committee-driven process. I'll say this. You know, we have seen in recent years, or the last, I guess, couple of decades, really, we see power being more centralized within the leadership and sort of leadership. You know, in both chambers sort of directing legislation. But with that being said, a lot of your, you know, everyday bills, yes, it's very much a committee driven process. So if you're a stakeholder organization, a group, and you want to see a bill move, you're ideally suited if it's introduced by a more senior member of Congress, a member who's in the majority party, and if they sit on that committee of jurisdiction. That's not a hard and fast rule. That's not to say a member of the minority party who's, you know, brand new member can't have a bill that ultimately makes it through the entire legislative process and who doesn't sit in the committee. But for purposes of sort of, you know, to be ideally suited, yes, you have a member who's on that particular committee, has, you know, has sort of a lot of experience moving bills through that committee. And so that's one thing we wanted to stress, was very, very much a committee-driven process from A to Z.
Tom and Joe, I'm going to ask a question real quick that may fit in here. I have someone asking about when is the public able to see a bill? They mentioned that newspapers often cover debates. Then you hear legislators say, I haven't had a chance to see that. Is there a rule of when things should be publicly available, so if you are following the issue, you know how you can get engaged?
Yeah, let me take a shot at that, Tom, and then also invite you to jump in. I'm going to say this too, Rachel. Thanks for that question. I think that's a great question. You know, things were a little bit different in going back to 2020 and 2021 with Congress working remotely. We had some interesting nuances in terms of bill introduction. We had, I would say, there was some lag time between actually press releases coming out and members saying, you know, announcing that a bill was introduced, and then someone going to congress.gov and saying, why don't I see this piece of legislation? So I just want to sort of the caveat or the disclaimer is there were some different nuances with regard to bill in introduction this year and lag time because Congress is doing remote work. It's just it's gone a little bit differently. But generally speaking, you know, people should be able to see a bill certainly listed on congress.gov, oftentimes the day it is introduced. You're right, the person alluded to the fact that sometimes you'll see in the press, a bill was introduced. It may not be up on congress.gov right away, but within a day or two. And again, sometimes there's a lag time with a press release and things of that nature. I think the individual also alluded to the fact that, you know, members will say sometimes, well, I haven't been able to read this bill. I don't know what's in it. That sort of speaks to kind of what we're going to get into a little bit later on as far as the dynamic legislative process and, you know, language and amendments that are added into bills and members saying, I would say rightfully so, they haven't had a chance to read the bill. It's like thousands of pages long and it's being rammed through the legislative process. So maybe not a neat answer to provide to you on that, but generally speaking, if folks want to see a bill and you know the bill number, you can go to congress.gov, you can put the bill number in there. If you don't know the bill number, you can search by sponsor. And it's pretty user-friendly as far as searching by sponsor from the House or the Senate, or if you know the key terms, or if you wanted to do a search on, you know, I want to look up bills on nutrition, you can put that keyword in. So there's ways to do that. And again, congress.gov is sort of the way to go. And Tom, I don't know if you want to add to that.
The only other thing to add, Joe, is you can also find on congress.gov the congressional record, which is basically the transcription of what occurred on both the House and Senate floors in terms of debate, in terms of any sort of statement of introduction on bills, the bills that were introduced that day. The congressional record is typically published the following day. So it's another source of information that you can go to learn what's happening on both the floors and in what bills were introduced the previous day.
Exactly. So with that, yeah, I think number three in the previous slide, no need to go back, by the way, was the floor vote. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on that. You could spend an entire day talking about the different nuances and, you know, different rules that govern consideration of bills on the House floor versus the Senate floor. And I'm not sure that there's any single person on this earth who honestly knows every single rule in both chambers. It's extremely arcane and complex. A lot of complaint this year from folks in the Senate saying we really need to simplify the rules of the Senate. So we won't get into all that. But if a bill has the support of the majority and it's gotten its way through committee, it's obviously going to see a floor vote. We have here on number four, the other chamber may consider the bill in their committee. Sometimes what happens is a bill goes through a House committee, hits the House floor, goes right over to the Senate for a full vote in the Senate. It may be that a Senate committee has taken a look at a companion bill or a piece of legislation there, but that's not always the case. So there's no hard and fast rule. Again, this is a very dynamic process. It doesn't sort of always follow a neat and easy path, but you obviously do have to have the dual chamber consideration. If it's following the normal process, you would have, and this is number five here, you would have a House and Senate conference committee. This is sort of the old school traditional way of legislating. And I think one of our next slides, we talk a little bit about how things have changed in Congress and how they've just how the process has changed dramatically. But if something's following regular order, both the House and Senate approve a bill, oftentimes there's a difference there. And in order to reconcile those differences, you call a conference committee. So you get key members from the House, key members of the Senate appointed by the leadership to reconcile those in a conference committee. Assuming they do that, it's called a conference report. That final bill then goes back to both the House and the Senate. Again, identical pieces of legislation. Assuming they're approved, it goes on to the president. Of course, folks are aware that, you know, the president either signs a bill into law or can veto it. And there's other things like a pocket veto, which again, we probably don't need to dive into, but that's sort of if it's following regular order. And Tom, I think maybe you were going to add
it. Yeah, I was just going to, I was thinking too, Joe, in terms of the committee process, both the House and Senate conference committees, but also the committees in the House and the Senate that are considering legislation. There are two types of events. There are hearings on the legislation, which they bring in witnesses. Usually the majority party gets to bring in a few more witnesses than the minority party. but that helps establish sort of a legislative history or the reason for a particular piece of legislation. And then after that, after those hearings are conducted, they have what is called a markup, which is literally what it means. The piece of legislation is marked up. If there's an amendment, they will strike out a particular provision of the legislation and then write in the new amendment. So hearings and markups are the two key concepts for committee action. And now, I guess for a number of years now, they're public and they're available oftentimes via the web by the committees. Each committee has their own sort of structure, but if you know that there's a hearing coming up, you can go to that committee website, click on the hearing and watch it either live or watch a taped version of it.
One final point to make, thank you, Tom, for that important notes on the committee activity. One important note on floor action, and again, I think folks are probably aware, and this has been talked about quite a bit, and we're gonna get a little bit into the reconciliation process in the Senate, which is interesting and sort of wonky. But in the House, you need a simple majority for most things, and in the Senate, the magic number is 60 to get cloture on most legislation of consequence. It's not true of everything that moves through the Senate. There are some exceptions to that rule, but generally speaking, you need the 60 votes to have cloture to cut off debate and move forward with the bill. And that's obviously in a very closely divided Senate. You can't get any closer than the 50-50 split in the current U.S. Senate. But generally speaking, again, you need the 60 votes. So it speaks to, again, the way that the founders put the rules of the Senate together. That was by design. There are a lot of folks who are, of course, calling for the filibuster. The 60 vote threshold to be completely removed just due, the will of the majority in the Senate. But one important thing to mention that 60 is generally that key number for Senate floor votes to get to cloture before you would then need a simple majority to pass the bill.
Well, Joe, we actually had someone ask about the filibuster. So I haven't watched the news. So something's happening today, I think. They're asking why, what was Biden's desire to have people talk, don't understand how it's operationalized now and why it's so controversial.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's any breaking news now about anything in the filibuster today in the Senate. I'll say this, they've been talking about it for quite a while now, particularly this year as they try to move forward some pieces of legislation. Folks are probably aware that the American Rescue Plan Act was moved through the budget reconciliation process, which was, again, we'll talk a little bit more about it, it's filibuster proof, but there is ongoing discussion from folks. There's not unanimity on this within the Democratic caucus in particular, saying we ought to get rid of the filibuster, that 60 vote threshold. Again, I don't know if there's breaking news about something happening today. They're negotiating, I think, as everyone is aware, a huge piece of legislation, the Build Back Better Act. So there's talk there, but gets very tricky, very messy. There's an infrastructure bill attached to that. So yeah, there's calls to reform what the Senate process is. And Tom, I don't know if
you want to... Well, and even with that, Joe, clearly with if the Democrats actually tried to move to do away with the filibuster, there are Democrats who would be very reluctant to do so because they know at some point the shift in power will go back to the GOP on the Senate side, and Democrats then being in the minority would not want to have the filibuster off on the wayside. So it is tricky. There's been a lot of discussion about it, but I don't know how they would totally eliminate the filibuster, but they may fine tune it in terms of specific pieces of legislation, but that's we get really tricky really quickly.
Right. We should probably go to the next slide, I think.
So this is an example. The Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act is indeed an example of a bill that went through the process. It was introduced on the Senate side by Senator Blanche Lincoln. She was a Democrat from Arkansas. The bill number that bill received was S-3307. There were a number of hearings that were held in the Senate. It was Senate Agriculture Committee was the committee of referral. The committee voted on that bill on May 5th, and it was what they say it was reported out to the full Senate. And it took a number of months before they brought it to a vote on the Senate side. And I don't remember exactly the details, but the Senate passed it by what is called unanimous consent, which meant that no one objected to the legislation. They didn't have to do an up or down vote, but the Democrats and Republicans, both sides of the aisle, questioned their rank and file members to find out if anybody had any objection to the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. No one did. So on August 5th of that year, it was adopted on the floor by unanimous consent, which usually means it was just a very quick vote. There might have been statements in support of the legislation by as many members who wished to do so, but it was passed by what we also call UC. At that stage, it was then referred over to the House Education and Labor Committee. There were already a number of other bills similar to the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act introduced in the House, not exactly the Senate bill, but a number of bills that were similar to it. Education and Labor looked at it. They went to leadership, both the House and both the Democrats and Republicans, and they decided to essentially accept the Senate bill. They brought it to what is called the Rules Committee of the House. The Rules Committee of the House essentially sets the guidelines for floor debate. Would there be any amendments allowed? How long will it be the debate? And so forth. That rule was a pretty straightforward rule. The House passed the rule on December 1st, and then on the 2nd of December, a bipartisan vote was made to approve the bill, and then sent over to the president. President Obama, because of the nature of this legislation, had a public signing, and you see that a picture of that there. And the public law was assigned that day, and it was public law 111-296. The 111 relates to the session of Congress. It was the 111th session of Congress. With that, Rachel, let's go to the next slide. So as Joe sort of alluded to, all too often lately, Congress, for numerous reasons, has avoided a lot of those steps that we just walked through. As you can see from a number of the boxes here, a number of the bills, they are COVID related, so there was some urgency to pass them. And most of them were adopted by Democrats only. But on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, those steps were pretty much bypassed by the Republicans who were in control at that point. So over time, unfortunately, a lot of this process has become very partisan, and there have been very few occasions of late where a member crosses over to join the other party, either in support or opposition to the legislation. And I think right now you see within the Senate, Senator Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, and Senator Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, are sort of examples of individuals who may cross over or at least object to a bill. And if they, with the Build Back Better Act if they object to any provision in there before it's sent to the floor. Given the 50 vote rule on the Senate side, the bill would die. Next slide, please.
So, and actually, Tom, if I just may just add in sort of an editorial comment, I guess the way I would say it is lately, you know, the way I would describe this for the group is this is not your grandparents' legislative process in recent times, and not just in the sort of the COVID legislating era. I would say even preceding 2020, things have been very different in Congress. You know, I think, again, skipping steps, yes, pretty big. You know, the process, I think we alluded to before, that sometimes they call it ping-ponging back and forth. It's, you know, we've seen bills that have been introduced, no hearings, no committee consideration. It gets a floor vote. It gets pinged and then ponged back and forth between the chambers. There's debates. There's a lot of complaints. Those are things that I think you hear about in the press saying, hey, you know, we didn't get to read this bill. And again, I think with the coronavirus pandemic, there was obviously, it was a national emergency. So there was some justification behind trying to move things quickly to get relief to communities and response efforts. But again, we've seen this outside of the COVID-19 response legislation as well. You know, and one of the other things that I would stress too is if there's a will, there's a way. You know, if you've got, again, like in the Senate, if you've got all 50 Democrats on board and obviously the vice president breaking the tie, you know, things can get done if you've got that. And it doesn't, even if someone says, well, this isn't following the rules, you know, this isn't the way it's supposed to be, fine and good. But if if they've got the votes, they will do it. They will find a way to ram it home free. And also from an advocate standpoint and stakeholder standpoint, really what you want in cases like this when the process is so topsy-turvy is you want a champion in Congress and you want staff who are doing everything they can to move a particular bill through. And they're not going to, you know, normally turn to folks and say, you know, help us understand the process for getting this through. They will be advised by leadership how they can get it done and cross the finish line. So just something I want to stress is that, yeah, things have changed and that's kind of become a bit of the norm. And who knows, maybe we'll go back to a more regular order once we get beyond. Again, we're still seeing some of the recovery legislation going through. But just important to note, things have changed quite a bit. Anyway, go ahead, Tom.
All right, thanks, Joe. So this next slide that you see just outlines some of the recent nutrition legislative achievements or enhancements. And most of them, I think all of those, yes, all of those were enacted in various pieces of COVID legislation, including the 15% increase in the SNAP benefit that expired on September 30th. That 15% increase translated to about a $27 per individual per month benefit for most of this year. While it did expire on September 30th, that next day was the day that the Thrifty Food Plan received an update from the administration. The Thrifty Food Plan increase in benefit was actually a net increase in benefits, even with the elimination or termination of the SNAP benefit. WIC boosts were also part of the one of the COVID bills, particularly the cash value voucher, which increased the voucher for fruits and vegetable purchases for WIC participants by about threefold. And then other benefits or enhanced funding under congregate meals in the Older Americans Act. So they did find within those COVID bills, even though they didn't go through the step-by-step legislative process, there were some enhancements in nutrition in the bills that we've seen over the last year and a half. Next slide, Rachel. So this is another slide. Joe and I will give you 10 bonus points if you can read any of it, but It's a slide that actually was first introduced by the House GOP a few years ago. They made it sort of a political statement. They wanted to stress that the welfare state had gotten out of control. But I've used it a little bit. I have some disagreements of where they placed some of these programs. But it's a good takeaway to show that there are hundreds of programs that that support or reach families in terms of education, human services, housing, et cetera. And that top left-hand corner, which you can't see very well, are the housing, or not housing, the nutrition supports that that are enacted and authorized by our committees of jurisdiction in both the House and the Senate. So it's, you know, multiple programs. So given that there are multiple programs, it's really important to know where does nutrition fit in terms of the jurisdiction. So next slide. This just gives you a very simplified version of the committees and jurisdiction over nutrition programs. Clearly, these committees have jurisdiction over many, many other programs. And you'll see the two on the right there are House committees, and they don't necessarily line up very well with what happens on the Senate side. So it's important to know, if you're involved in federal legislation, to know which committees have jurisdiction over these programs. As you see, House Education and Labor, for year in and year out, typically has most jurisdiction over most nutrition programs, with the House Agriculture Committee having jurisdiction over SNAP. SNAP is essentially only reviewed / reauthorized every 5 years during the Farm Bill. But SNAP, as part of the Farm Bill, is roughly 3/4 of the funding under the Farm Bill goes to SNAP. But anyhow, this gives you a sense of where those programs lie. And again, they don't line up perfectly between the House and the Senate committees. Next slide. I'm going to turn it over. Well, before we do the budget process, Rachel, are there any other questions on legislation that we could answer now? If not now, we certainly can answer at the end of the webinar.
Yeah, the only pending question I have is an update on the issues, timing related to child nutrition reauthorization, and particularly nutrition education.
Sure, happy to do that. Given the intense focus on the reconciliation bill, the Build Back Better Act, and on the Hard Infrastructure Act, and on the debt limit, and on just the normal appropriations process, the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Bill, I don't see any further movement this year. That we're going to have to take another run at it next year. Time is limited. We're already approaching November. There'll be holidays over Thanksgiving and then the Christmas break. So CNR is going to have to wait until 2022 at the earliest.
Thanks, Tom. And so we're into the budget process, and I see we're probably about 20 minutes out from the top of the hour. So we're going to, I think, try to move through kind of some of these remaining slides very efficiently. But and so with that being said, the budget process, yeah, kind of want to make sure to provide the group with a sort of a basic understanding of what we're talking about here. And I'll say this too, we'll talk about this a little bit more. We've got our next slide to talk about key terms, the budget and appropriations process. Those things are normally, you know, sort of used interchangeably, and we'll explain the difference there. But the budget process, and actually I'll back up even further. I'll say this. People hear about must pass pieces of legislation. Congress doesn't have to pass any bills, except maybe arguably the federal budget, because if they don't pass the appropriations bills, you have a government shutdown. And folks are aware that we've had some government shutdowns in recent times due to disagreements, in some cases over federal spending directly related to the budget, in some cases disagreements over things that are ancillary to that or completely irrelevant to the budget. Affordable Care Act disagreements, for example, led to a recent government shutdown. So, but yes, the federal budget, the appropriations, that is a must-pass bill. That's something Congress needs to do. They never get a budget done on time, and never is not an exaggeration if you're talking about the last 20 years, but that is a must-pass bill. So the budget process in a nutshell. The first step is the president submits budget request to Congress, and think about this as a very detailed wish list. The president's budget does provide a sort of an overarching, fiscal policy goal, objectives. There's usually a 10-year, budget window attached to that. This is what the administration wants to do, again, within a 10-year budget window, but really then focusing on that upcoming fiscal year. We'll talk about the deadlines in a minute here, but that's usually early in the year, and sometimes that deadline slips. But that's the first step. President and the administration get together, and if you were to stack all the budget documents up, they would be from floor to ceiling, because it covers every federal department, every agency, extraordinarily detailed spending levels for every single individual federal program is included in those budget numbers and appendixes and et cetera. It's, again, if you've worked with the budget, you know it's a very lengthy, huge, complex document. But it is official. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Joe, and in addition to the spending levels, the requested spending levels, you will find oftentimes their policy proposals for the upcoming calendar year.
Absolutely. Oftentimes from a political standpoint, oftentimes the opposing party in Congress will always say the budget is quote unquote dead on arrival, that it's not going to happen. Again, it sort of speaks to the political dance that takes place between the administration and the opposing party on the Hill, saying, we don't agree with, again, as Tom said, some of the policy proposals that are in there or the overall spending levels or fiscal vision included in the budget. If things follow a regular order, the House and Senate do pass, mark up and pass a budget resolution. A budget resolution, by the way, is a non-binding document that does not get a signature by the president, but the House Budget Committee and the Senate Budget Committee, again, under regular order, will take up a budget resolution, which is actually a pretty basic document, sets the sort of overall spending targets for any given fiscal year. And again, we've had years in the past, actually, where we haven't had a final budget resolution. So even though it's certainly very helpful and sort of helps to grease the wheels for the budget process, I will note that there are times you actually do not get a final budget resolution through Congress and reconciled. We do have here on the slides, after you have a budget resolution, I'm going to move quickly through this, but the Appropriations Committee. So what's the difference? Think of the budget committees as sort of setting those targets, and then the Appropriations Committees, actually, that's where the rubber meets the road. Those are the ones that have the power of the purse. Totally separate committee on the Hill. There are 12, by the way, appropriations bills that make up the unified federal budget. But once that budget resolution is passed, it's the job of the Appropriations Committees to then go ahead and write that spending legislation. We have the term here, reconciliation/authorization. I will note we do not mean the budget reconciliation process in the sense that we're going to talk about in a minute. We're talking about sort of reconciling the appropriations bills. What you normally have, we'll have a set of appropriations bills coming out of the House that are in some cases very different than what's coming out of the Senate. And so ideally, yes, they have a conference committee or they reconcile the differences between those and they get those passed. October 1 is when the new fiscal year begins. I don't think we've had a unified budget passed on time literally in 20 years. The quote unquote trains used to run on time in terms of the federal budget. You had the chairs of the Appropriations Committee really focusing on that, wanting to have a new federal budget in place by October 1st, which makes everybody happy and makes planning for budgetary purposes much better. But that just doesn't happen. Things are so political up on Capitol Hill. We normally don't have the final budget / appropriations process done until very late in any given year, usually right before the holidays. So that's a quick look at that. And then we're going to talk about this a bit more on the next slide, Rachel.
Well, I do have a question that came in. So what is the status of the old pay/go requirement? Where did it originate and what degree is it honored?
Boy, that is a really good question. Somebody tracks this stuff pretty closely. That's a good question. I think it's because everything has been of such an emergent nature over the last couple of years. They have waived PAYGO. There isn't really a hard and fast rule on, and PAYGO means you have to find the revenues to offset or pay for the program that is being considered. So you have to pay for it in order for that program to go, essentially.
Yeah, and I'll just say this, I could be wrong, but I believe the historical, because the question was asked, where did it originate? It might have been the 1974 Budget Act. I don't recall exactly. It's a bit arcane, I think, as Tom has alluded to, as far as that goes. And yes, they do often waive those PAYGO rules. You've heard about it the last couple of years, and as they've talked about budget reconciliation, for example, of, you know, hey, we've got to have these new things paid for or offset before we move forward. So those rules are in place. Technically, they're in place, but they can be waived within Congress. But yeah, that gets in a very that gets deep and complex very fast.
And speaking of terms of art, authorization versus appropriation, which is the first part of this slide, authorizations are within the in many of the bills that are introduced. Will authorize spending for either a current program or a new program. The authorization basically would direct the appropriators to spend up to a certain dollar amount for that particular program. So if a program is authorized for $100 million each and every year, the appropriators have the discretion to give that program anywhere from $0 to $100 million. So you'll find oftentimes, and members on both sides of the aisle will do this, they'll introduce a piece of legislation and they will say that child nutrition, my bill is going to increase program child nutrition program X by $250 million a year. Well, yes, it may increase the program by that amount, but it really is going to be determined by the Appropriations Committee. If indeed that bill is enacted into law, the Appropriations Committee will then take a look at that enacted piece of legislation and determine at their level how much that particular program would be funded.
Yeah, I think that's a key one for folks to understand the difference. Again, it can get complex and those terms are thrown around quite a bit. But yeah, just because bottom line is just because something's been authorized and just because Congress has gone through and done a whole lot of work to, you know, create a brand new federal program or modify an existing federal program or create this new authorization with this huge, you know, spending ceiling doesn't mean it's going to get a dime is the bottom line. The money would have to be appropriated for that. And that's kind of the takeaway there.
I'll touch upon entitlement versus discretionary and then give you the budget reconciliation 30-second description. Entitlement versus discretionary funds. So entitlements are, for federal purposes, entitlements are programs that just basically have automatic spending embedded in them and that are not subject to the appropriations process. For instance, the SNAP, when the president proposes a budget, they project how much SNAP will need in the next federal fiscal year. That number can be changed a little bit, but the appropriators do not have any power to say, no, we reject the president's proposal for SNAP because it is an entitlement. Discretionary programs, again, getting back to the authorization versus appropriation issue, discretionary programs, while aren't the lion's share of the federal budget, those are the programs that the appropriators have discretion to determine how much money each and every program would receive.
Exactly. And keep a look at the time. I think what we're going to do is maybe we'll move past earmarks, which I think folks have probably heard about quite a bit, and that's gotten a lot of press, and those were brought back this past year. And then also supplemental appropriations, which is just basically refers to emergency spending bills that Congress would pass. But yeah, real quick on budget reconciliation. And again, you could spend an entire seminar on this, and I think folks have heard quite a bit about it because it's been used in recent times. And it's being talked about right now to move a huge chunk of President Biden's economic agenda, which is being called the Build Back Better Act. That would conceivably go through the budget reconciliation process. If there's sort of one main takeaway on that or a couple main takeaways, it's you can't use it for everything. It's a specialized process in both the House and in the Senate. can't use it for everything. You can't use it, for example, the Senate parliamentarian has ruled twice this year. You can't use it to pass immigration legislation, to change a law on immigration. What you can use it for is generally think of it as a sort of tax spending budgetary impact bill, which is what, again, the Build Back Better Act legislation would do. That is a huge spending package that would move through. And, you know, it can touch entitlements and mandatory spending. It can touch other types of spending. And the big takeaway, and we talked about it earlier, is that a budget reconciliation bill, this is the key, it's insulated from a filibuster again in the Senate. So there are expedited procedures in both chambers, including in the House, but in the Senate, if it's on reconciliation, you need 51 votes to move it. That's the key takeaway for that. It's been used recent times. It's potentially going to be used again if they can come up with a political agreement on Build Back Better. But I think we can we have a few more things we want to go over before we hit the top of the hour. So Rachel, if we could go to the next slide, please. Oh, these were the budget process official deadlines, maybe a little bit out of order here. We talked about it. So this is if they hit the regular order, first Monday in February is the budget. April 15th is when we talked about the House and Senate committees hitting that. And then October 1, which that deadline is consistently missed. We can actually go to the next slide.
So federal regulatory process, again, this is a chart that nobody can read, but it just sort of demonstrates how involved the regulatory process can be, the many, many, many steps that are involved. But the next slide will give you the basic process that that Joe's going to describe briefly.
Yeah, and so this is an important one. And you know, I think a lot of times, you know, obviously legislation, what's happening up on Capitol Hill gets most of the press and most of the airtime. But you know, pretty much every time Congress passes a bill, there's going to be a directive and especially major legislation for agencies to use their expertise to implement the bills. You know, Congress sometimes does get prescriptive in legislation, try to sort of undercut an agency or make it very clear to them what they're looking to do. But oftentimes, because again, this is what we talked about earlier with the committee process and they have so many things of jurisdiction, it's so complex, there is going to be quite a bit of deference shown to the federal departments and agencies to implement these bills. Congress just, they don't have time for that. So again, a piece of legislation is an initiating event for a regulation to move forward. A court decision can precipitate a new regulation or change in regulation, as can simply, for example, this year with the new administration coming in, folks probably will recall that you know, as soon as President Biden came in, there were a number of day one executive orders saying we are going to take a look at everything pretty much under the sun that the previous administration did. We are going to look at memorandums and guidance and rules and regulations, and we are.
Joe, did you?
I'm going to look to modify those. In some guidances could be changed just kind of with the flip of a switch, but not the case when it. Oh, go ahead, Tom. Sorry, a little laggy there.
No, I know. I was saying you.
Sorry,
you
I had a hiccup. Did you want to add anything?
I don't know if you broke up on everybody else.
Okay, I apologize if that's the case. I had some really earth-shattering things I was saying there, but in any case, I was going to move a little bit further through the regulatory process here, just so folks are aware of it. When an agency proposes a rule, it's in the Federal Register, so it's you know, public knowledge. Folks can see that. Sometimes an agency will do an advance notice to propose rulemaking, so it isn't an actual sort of initial notice. It's a step even, you know, removed from that, giving folks an update as, hey, we're thinking about doing a proposed regulation. But again, that gets published in the Federal Register, and they have to do a general description. This is what we're looking to do. They'll talk about deadlines and sort of timelines in that as well. And again, that regulation can be precipitated by some of the events that I described earlier. Hopefully that wasn't cut off as part of the presentation here. Public comment period is always under the Administrative Procedures Act, there's going to be a public comment period for stakeholders to comment on a proposed regulation. 30 days is the minimum, but sometimes you can see 60, 90, or even 180 days, sometimes more. If it's an extraordinarily complex regulation, you can see even additional time afforded to stakeholders to comment on a proposed regulation. Once an agency prepares the final rule, This is after, by the way, they've reviewed public comments, which under the Administrative Procedures Act, they are supposed to do. And they are supposed to respond to significant comments that come in from stakeholders after they've done. And oftentimes that will, by the way, change the substance of a proposed rule. But once they do that, they can prepare and publish in the Federal Register a final rule, which becomes, and 30 days from there, that becomes the law of the land. And then it goes into the Code of Federal Regulations. That's sort of the quick and dirty. Tom, I don't know if you want to add to that.
I was just going to say, you know, and there isn't usually any sort of hard and fast rule in terms of when they have to issue the final rule. It often depends on how many comments are received. And nowadays, those comments may be viewed on regulations.gov. That's typically where individuals, organizations, post their comments, and they are a matter of public record. Why don't we go to the next slide, Rachel? These are just some of the examples of nutrition regulations. Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, you know, it took them 3 years to release the initial final rule. There's been back and forth on flexibilities for milk, whole grains, and sodium. So we've seen multiple bites at the apple, so to speak, on those flexibilities, given whoever is sits in the White House, and then other nutrition regulations are shown here as well. Let's just move, since we are, Rachel, getting close to the hour. Let's quickly go through some advocacy 101 steps. So how may you affect nutrition? You know, clearly one of the currencies you have is putting your policy into words. The product of Congress, of advocates, are sentences, paragraphs. And if you're as specific as you can be in your policy objective, that will help the legislator understand what you want. And it will also give the legislative council, if that legislator agrees to that particular concept, it gives the legislative council, who actually writes the bill, a much better idea of what the policy objective is, if it is succinctly and clearly outlined initially. In DC, building coalitions is the name of the game. It's very rare that an idea, a concept, is proposed by just one or two individuals and makes it through the process. Lots of people want to take a look at it. So building a coalition through sharing your priorities with like-minded individuals, and then continue to follow up on those priorities with the members of Congress and their staff. Let's go to the next slide that'll show some of those steps you can take in advocating your position. Joe, can you take this one?
You got it. Yeah, and this, thanks, Tom. This builds on what Tom was just saying. And I, you know, again, these are just sort of some pro tips, hopefully, for those who are interested in the lobbying or advocacy game. You know, if folks have a relationship with a member of Congress, you can talk directly to a member of Congress, that's great. But oftentimes it's even better actually to talk to the staff, because those are the ones that are doing the day-to-day work. So know your audience. Legislative assistant, or LA, is the acronym that uses, is usually going to be the point on any given issue. Oftentimes a legislative director on Capitol Hill will also handle issues directly, or what they call a legislative correspondent. But there's actually, you know, directories and things you can use, or you can call an office and say, hey, can you tell me who handles any particular issue? But it's typically going to be a legislative assistant who has hopefully a good degree of expertise on an issue. Although I will point out, there's a lot of turnover on Capitol Hill. It's always been the case. It's not unusual to find staff say, hey, I was just handed these issues, or I just came on board because of the turnover, which is why it's even more important, and why they rely on outside expertise and groups to help them and steer them in the right direction. So again, your contact is going to be generally staff within any given House office or any given Senate office. And then again, committee staff as well. If you're going to kind of go the next layer deep, you're going to talk to committee staff who almost always will have a degree of expertise on the issues. Keeping it simple, go ahead.
Just one, I know we're running a little bit over time, but just another note on what Joe talked about with the legislative assistants. They, yes, there is oftentimes turnover, and a legislative assistant, if he or she covers nutrition issues, they may also, or most likely will be covering all health and human services and maybe housing issues as well. So they will not be an expert on that particular issue that you're bringing forward to them. And, you know, after COVID, if you have the opportunity to meet with these individuals in person, don't be surprised if you enter a congressional office and have that meeting in their sort of their reception area or out in the hall. Unlike what you may see on TV, these offices are extremely cramped, and most meetings are indeed taken outside of the office environment and actually in that reception area or even out in the hall.
Absolutely. Another thing to mention, if folks have done meetings on Capitol Hill or with your member, you'll know that, you know, typically it's 30 minutes. That's more true in person. You know, in a virtual platform, folks can go over time. Case in point, we're going over time, but a few more minutes here. But yeah, you know, typically you actually do want to be concise in your meeting anyway. So 30 minutes is a good rule of thumb for meeting with a member of Congress, for that matter, or their staff. It's just kind of, that's sort of the industry standard, if you will. And that's why you want to keep it simple. You don't need to get into a lot of complexities. I think the more simple message, the more direct ask is kind of the way you want to go. You know, we've worked with all sorts of clients I have across, you know, 25 years, and have seen folks, you know, get intimidated when they're talking about, oh my gosh, going up on Capitol Hill, meeting with staff. It's more straightforward than some might think. And, you know, chances are you're the expert, they're not. So you go in, you keep your message simple. That's the best way to do it. We have also here making it local. Absolutely. You've heard the adage, all politics is local. I think that's true in many respects. And, you know, members of the House and, you know, a senator wants to hear, how does it affect my folks back home? What's the impact locally? Congressional leadership might wear that sort of broader, you know, bigger hat. How is it going to affect the nation? But generally speaking, politics are going to be local. Make your argument local. Talk about how it affects, you know, the folks back home. That's going to be the most persuasive, you know, way to do that. Using data, that's how you back up your points. In fact, you know, the data that you hand off, you'll often see then, you know, translated and used in a press release or, you know, in talking points at a hearing. You know, really most offices do a great job of again, trying to build the most persuasive argument as they go to talk to other members of Congress as to why they want to move a particular policy. So in this case, it's okay, I think, for some briefing papers to be detailed and make sure you have the data to back up, you know, the points that you're making. And then finally, make it special, I think, is sort of related to making it local. But if there's something there that you can use, an anecdote, a story, you know, go ahead and feel free to share that, because, again, those are the things that maybe, you know, will make your meeting more memorable to the staff and the member of Congress. So, you know, feel free to share as much as you're able to about your particular situation as you look to be persuasive. Tom, you want to add anything to that?
I think you got it, Joe. I know we're running over a little on time, Rachel. Does anybody have any questions before we close out the webinar?
I do have one question in the block. What is the role of the GAO in the regulatory process? When comments are in and analyzed by the originating agency, how does the OMB decide if it's all good or should stand?
Boy, two good questions. So the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, is basically tasked by Congress to take a look at the operation, administration of existing federal programs, and to report back to Congress on their findings. With respect to OMB, yes, I mean, with the regulatory process, OMB is sort of the final step. The administering agency of that rule will draft the rule, the proposed final rule, but it's sent over to the White House / the Office of Management and Budget for their final review. And they may ping pong it back and forth a little bit. Not necessarily, OMB can't necessarily just reject the proposed rule out of hand, but they can nuance it a little bit. And they also do the same in the budget process, where the administration through their agencies will propose certain budget levels. OMB is basically tasked with putting the entire budget together. So there'll be back and forth on budget proposed items within the administration, with OMB essentially on the budget having final say in terms of what it will look like when it's presented during that February time period.
And I'll just say this, really, really insightful questions. I'm impressed. I will say, yeah, I mean, I think Tom hit it on the head. I'll say, you know, think of GAO as the investigative arm of the government. Oftentimes members of Congress will ask for or direct GAO to study a particular issue. So if you've got it, if there's a particular, you know, problem or challenge or something, GAO can study something and audit that. And that can in turn be used to inform the development of legislation. And then again, I would think of OMB then as sort of the gatekeeper. And key to the budget process, we had to kind of move through the budget and regulatory process quickly. But yes, OMB is a gatekeeper on all the federal spending. They're going to look at, they do something called OMB passback, where a federal agency says, hey, here's our budget, this is what we want. And then OMB may look at that and say, ah, not so fast, because they kind of have a broader perspective on, well, the administration wants to go in this direction, we can't quite spend this much or focus on this. So they're a bit of a gatekeeper as they review, and including on you know, the regulatory side as well. They'll take a look at regulations, as will the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, by the way. It's another arm of the you know, the feds, that'll take a look at regulations. So yeah, there's multiple steps within certainly the regulatory process. Very, very complex, and a lot of cooks in the kitchen.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I don't have any other questions, but thank you for providing your contact information. And as we said before, Tom works closely with SNEB as policy advisor to ACPP. You'll see his policy updates by email every other week. When he meets with the ACPP committee and gives a federal update, we try to share those out as well. So appreciate both gentlemen making themselves available for the webinar today. Just a reminder, when I close the webinar, there's a short survey. Would really appreciate your ideas for future policy related trainings. Also in the chat, I included a link to some policy resources that SNEB has organized over time. And then just one last follow-up, there will be an email later this week with a link to the recording, the handout, and your CEU certificate. So as always, more SNEB webinars up on the SNEB website. And so we look forward to seeing you back in a future session.
Thanks all.